Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
Okay, so looking at the handout here, I'll be working through those sections. Just a first, a basic distinction in politics between good rule and bad rule, rule for the sake of the ruled versus rule for the sake of the ruler. Then look at what I'm going to call the original Benedict option, St. Benedict himself, 1,500 years ago. Then the postmodern Benedict option, we'll look at that and say, well, what is, when people say Benedict option today, this is what they have in mind. What is that? And then offer some Thomistic points of reflection for how to analyze the Benedict option. And I should say, when I've kind of retitled this, you'll see on the headout, on the handout, Head for the Hills question, a Thomistic response to the Benedict option, just to make it clear that I'm offering some principles from Aquinas that are the way that I would put them forth, and that Thomas would disagree about this, and I'm not going to try to channel Aquinas himself, but just try to use some of those principles. I want to begin with a quote. If you've seen the movie Apocalypto, which is pretty dated now, it was a Mel Gibson movie after The Passion of the Christ. He has this quote from Will Durant. A great civilization is not conquered from without until it has destroyed itself within. And I think this is what a broad group of Christian pundits and analysts are in agreement upon, that we are actually at the end of a civilization, that the barbarians are already among us and ruling us, and that Christians need to recognize that we are no longer in a Christian culture, a Christian politics, a Christian milieu, and need to shift the way that they act in the world as a result. So just some examples, George Weigel, just before the election, had a brief piece where he says that both the left and the right reject Christian anthropology. And so that while you now after the election, while there may be some Christians who are excited about Donald Trump and the possibility of undoing some policies that were not compatible with Christian living, this is merely a delay in the inevitable, that where we are headed and where we already are is an alternative understanding of what it means to be human to the biblical one. Patrick Deneen, who's at the University of Notre Dame, has written a couple books on the failures of liberalism, the post-liberal age. Scott Hahn speaks about a sort of sacralized politics. He's at Franciscan University of Steubenville. And so generally young Catholics who find themselves, who call themselves integralists, would be more of this view, that what we actually need is a stronger public Catholic role that the political community is subservient to, and that liberalism and separating church and state have failed. So there's a broad agreement about there being being at a stage in our history that we need to respond to, but disagreements about what the response would be. The Benedict option is just one of those that we're going to look at. But first, let's talk about the difference between a healthy politics, one that a Christian in the Thomistic understanding should seek out and embrace and act in concert with, as distinct from one that is tyrannical, unhealthy, or is actually pushing immorality. So look at that first quote. I wanted to I don't know how much of virtue ethics people share in common in their knowledge, but we want to start with this understanding that it's one thing to perfect my own character so that I perform individual virtuous actions, that my passions are moderated, that my hopes and fears are inspired by courage or rooted in courage, that my will wills the good of others, which is justice, and that my practical reason determines the means to bring about moral ends, and we call this prudence. But it's another thing to have a virtue that directs all of those actions to the good of my community, either to the body of Christ, which would be charity, to God, of course, or to my political community, to my nation, and this is general justice. So here's how Aquinas puts it in quote 1a. Just as the sun is the general cause of illumination and motion, legal justice is said to be a general virtue, inasmuch to wit, as it directs the acts of the other virtues to its own end, and this is to move all the other virtues by its command. For just as charity may be called a general virtue, insofar as it directs the acts of all the virtues to the divine good, so too is legal justice, insofar as it directs the acts of all the virtues to the common good. So Christians are broadly familiar with the claim from St. Paul that though I do all sorts of good works, if I do them without love, I am nothing, that love alone is what makes actions pleasing to God. But this claim that there is a virtue called general justice might not be as familiar. The idea here is that when I direct my actions to the good of a secular political community, I'm practicing general justice, and that general justice, first and foremost, exists in the political authorities. The thing of the political authorities is like coaches that call the plays, that provide the formation, and that the citizens then have general justice insofar as they obey, cooperate with, and support that common good that we all share in common, whether we're Christians or non-Christians. I think that the recent hurricanes provide a tragic example of this, that people who may be divided in a variety of issues hopefully came together and recognized that I have an obligation to, at the very least, not get in the way of emergency providers. At the very least, I need to make sure that I'm not making it harder for our authorities in our community to serve those who are in need. I may even be called on to engage in acts of moderation, to regulate my eating and drinking in light of the limited resources to others in need. And I may even be called upon to perform acts of courage, even as a private citizen, to the extent to which I'm capable and able to help those in rescue work. And so that's a good example of the healthy situation of the authorities and citizens working in common. Of course, and unfortunately, in this valley of tears, that is not the norm. The reality is that justice and injustice are often worked together, and often the injustice is so great that the response is very difficult to determine. Aquinas then helps us out by thinking about this in terms of different ways in which laws can be unjust in order to think about whether we can cooperate with political authority. So let's read quote 1b. Laws framed by man are either just or unjust. If they be just, they have the power of binding in conscience from the eternal law whence they are derived, according to Proverbs. By me kings reign, and lawgivers decree just things. On the other hand, laws may be unjust in two ways. First, by being contrary to human good, through being opposed to the things mentioned above. Either, and there's three ways in which they can be unjust in relation to human goods, either in respect of the end, as when authority imposes on his subjects burdensome laws, conducive not to the common good, but rather to his own cupidity or vainglory, or in respect of the author, is when a man makes a law that goes beyond the power committed to him, or in respect of the form, as when burdens are imposed unequally on the community, although with a view to the common good. The like are acts of violence rather than laws, because, as Augustine says, a law that is not just seems to be no law at all. Wherefore, such laws do not bind in conscience, and here's a very important qualification, except perhaps in order to avoid scandal or disturbance, for which cause a man should yield even his right, according to Matthew. If a man take away thy coat, let go thy cloak also unto him. And whosoever will force thee 1 mile, go with him other two. I think we could look at economic examples of this, that we recognize that economic policies, even when they are enacted with the goal of promoting the common good, don't always do that. That sometimes the very people that are intended to be helped by various kinds of economic policies are actually harmed by them. I think the election was very much about the question, of course, of economics and what policies ought to be pursued. And then there are other cases where those lawmakers are promoting their own special interest groups or their own private interest. And while those don't, in theory, bind our conscience, following Augustine there, and this is an important quote that Americans, thanks to Martin Luther King, are familiar with, an unjust law is no just law, no law at all. But in the concrete situation, because scandal and disturbance are very likely when there's any not obeying of the political authority, that we often need to yield our right. So we can imagine this. Imagine if this tax season, February and March, every American said, I'm just going to get a line item from the government of which taxes I support and which I don't. And I'll only pay the ones sounds like somebody likes that idea. I'll only pay the ones that I like, or the ones that I think are just. We realize that we're easily biased in our own self-interest, right? That when it comes to our own economic interest, it's hard to think about the common good and what's just. And that also, this would lead to anarchy. That living in a society does mean often yielding our right for the sake of the common good, following the traditional political adage that even tyranny is better than anarchy. And so Aquinas then wants to put the emphasis, as St. Paul does when talking about obedience to political authorities, that we ought to obey even when doing so is harming the common good. But yet, there are laws that we simply can't obey. So look at secondly there. Laws may be unjust through being opposed to the divine good. Such are the laws of tyrants inducing to idolatry or to anything else contrary to the divine law. And laws of this kind must nowise be observed, because as stated in Acts, we ought to obey God rather than man. So if there is a law, and this is leading us directly into the Benedict Cox show, if there are laws and policies in our country that are forcing Christians to choose between their conscience and their well-being, for example, their jobs if they work in the medical or pharmaceutical industry or even in public education, then we are in a situation where there really can't be a tolerance of those laws. That doesn't mean a revolution and fighting back, but it does mean that a Christian must take a stand and say, I simply cannot follow a law that requires me to reject my faith or that requires me to pronounce, to swear to an alien faith to mine. I simply can't do that. And so if the choice is between jail, martyrdom, etc., or obedience to the law, I have to obey God rather than man. The proponents of the Benedict option are claiming that all across America, we're increasingly seeing this situation. Not martyrdom necessarily, but perhaps jail in some cases, that whether you are in education industry, again, pharmacy, medicine, the health care providers, a variety of other fields, that the laws are now requiring you in order to do your job to do things that you can't in good conscience do. And so the response to this is to seek an alternative form of community living, to go kind of into a catacomb, as it were, into communities that would be an alternative and a refuge from the mainstream culture that is only going to get worse, according to these proponents. So it's hard to assess if that's true, and we'll come back to that. Is this the case that things are that bad and that people may, on the Christian right, may be more excited now than they were 2 weeks ago or a week ago even, that this is simply a delay of the collapse? We'll come back to that. But first, we need to look at history, look at the original Benedict option. Saint Benedict runs for the hills and draws Rome to him. So Saint Benedict is born in 480, yet right after the end of the Western Roman Empire in 476. It's being ruled by Ostrogoths, by barbarians. They're actually heretical Christians. They're Arians. And Benedict leaves Rome for this reason. So let's look at, well, I should say, not specifically for that reason, but for the sake of salvation. Let's look at this quote here from the Life of St. Benedict by St. Gregory the Great. Benedict was born in the province of Nursia to free parents, and he was sent to Rome to study the liberal arts. But when he discerned that many in these studies descend into a life of vice, he withdrew his foot, which he could have set forth into the world so that he might not also entirely fall into the huge pit after attaining some of this knowledge. Thus he left Rome knowingly ignorant and wisely untaught. After 3 years of solitude in a cave, he erected 12 monasteries. Noble and religious Romans also began to assemble around him and give their sons to be brought up for the service of God. So the Catholic Church has a sense of humor. One of the patron saints of students is a college dropout, Saint Benedict. So not that we're advocating that, right? But if the choice is between preserving your character and heading for the caves or wherever it may be, probably not the beach, then you've got a saint for you. So Saint Benedict goes out, lives in a cave, Subiaco. He formed himself as a spiritual master and goes then out to form alternative communities, monasteries, that in turn draw Rome to him. And so after this time, as Rome is collapsing, for the next 1,500 years to today, the Benedictine rule that he wrote has guided and continues to guide men and women in prayer and work to holiness as an alternative political constitution. So Americans, we have the by far the oldest written political constitution in the world that's still in use, some 240 years. The Benedictine rule has been in continuous use for 1,500 years. And is still accessible today. It's very small. You can see what's in the rule, and provides this stability so that even people who aren't monks, you know, can send their kids to the schools, who are called oblates. Like St. Thomas Aquinas himself was sent to be an oblate when he was 5 years old to a Benedictine monastery. And people would be drawn to these places that previously were wilderness throughout Europe and now throughout the world, form families and communities rooted in prayer, in the spiritual resources of the monastery, and in manual labor. So Benedictines are really committed to manual labor, farming and craftsmanship. And this provided economic stability as well as the development of the science of husbandry, animal husbandry and the like, and craftsmanship, preserving the liberal arts tradition and the Catholic intellectual tradition through some very dark times. So the claim is, going now to the postmodern Benedict option, is that something like that needs to happen today in order to preserve our heritage. And I want to pause for a second. And we do need to be aware, though, that Benedictine monasteries still exist. So there's something kind of interesting or odd that we want to make a question about. Why not actually go to Benedictine monasteries? They're still around. Why do we need something new here? And that's an interesting question of what would be different about this postmodern one. I want to be clear that I'm not calling it postmodern in the sense that I want to say that people advocating it are postmodernists, but in the sense that they're responding to the postmodern condition of moral relativism and a collapse of civility. So Alistair MacIntyre, who's still alive, is really one of the most important moral philosophers. I think he'll be being read for hundreds of years in the future. In the early 80s, he publishes this book, After Virtue, in which he claims that we, since the Enlightenment, the attempt to form an objective morality that rejected the tradition of the virtues has failed. It led to relativism, to Nietzsche and Sartre and so forth. And so the problem of the modern university, where relativism is the dominant form of discourse and the dominant way of engaging in any question, is a result of the disaster of trying to replace virtue ethics with something else. Toward the end of that book, and I should say, by and large, successful. My mentor, who went to St. Louis University in the 50s, he said at that time it was Kant and Mill. Those were the options. Ethics was Kant or Mill. And now, whether you're at a secular university or a Catholic university or a Christian university, virtue ethics is considered a viable option even by people who don't consider themselves Christians. And MacIntyre is one of the main reasons for that. But at the end of that book, he has just this one line. This is all he says that Dreyer is going to pick up on. So let's read it. He says, "If my account of our moral condition is correct, we ought also to conclude that for some time now, we too have reached that turning point of barbarism and darkness that Benedict faced. What matters at this stage is the construction of local forms of community within which civility and the intellectual and moral life can be sustained through the new dark ages which are already upon us. And if the tradition of the virtues was able to survive the horrors of the last dark ages, we are not entirely without grounds for hope. This time, however, the barbarians are not waiting beyond the frontiers. They have already been governing us for quite some time. And it is our lack of consciousness of this that constitutes part of our predicament. We are waiting not for Godot, but for another, doubtless very different, Saint Benedict." So what does that mean by a very different? So how would it be like Saint Benedict? How would it be different? Well, Rod Dreher claims to provide an answer to that. And we want to notice that he's writing this 35 years later. So if you feel like doomsday is upon us, already in the early 80s, MacIntyre is saying people need to wake up and recognize the reality, and Dreher is just calling attention to it. So in 2017, just before the pandemic, Rod Dreher publishes The Benedict Option, A Strategy for Christians in a Post-Christian Nation. Notice that whereas McIntyre is a philosopher who's really thinking about the intellectual issues, Dreyer is a journalist who is providing what he claims to be a strategy for actually putting this into practice. And here is how he describes this Benedict option. The idea of the Benedict option prophesied by McIntyre is that serious Christian conservatives could no longer live business as usual in America. Rather than wasting energy and resources fighting unwinnable political battles, we should instead work on building communities, institutions, and networks of resistance that can outwit, outlast, and eventually overcome the opposition. So his view is that Christians have been wasting their time for decades now in talking about America as a Christian nation, about reclaiming Washington, about focusing our energy on what at that time when the blogosphere and now social media and so forth, that instead what Christians ought to do is focus on real communities, real love of neighbor, not virtual statements about communities throughout the world, but actually forming them in families that can resist this kind of apocalypse of culture. I want to be clear that by resistance, he doesn't mean armed resistance. He's not advocating for that at all. He's really talking about religious liberty, so carving out a space for these communities. I'll mention just briefly, Leo Labresco has a book, Building the Benedict Option, that is a very nice domestic way of thinking through things like having potlucks and family events where Christians would come together in one another's homes and just build each other up in the faith, and that this is an even more practical way of trying to put this into practice. So what can Christians hope for from politics, as the Mac Benedict option proponents put it? This would be something like a return to St. Augustine, you know, that we're simply trying to be quiet, peaceful citizens who as much as possible follow the law and have our own community that keeps to itself, except in the sense of evangelizing both by the way of life that you live that's attractive and also by the freedom, of course, to go around and to proclaim the gospel. And so he puts it at 3C. The best that Orthodox Christians today can hope for from politics is that it can open a space for the church to do the work of charity, culture building, and conversion. So if you feel called to go into law or into politics, there is a role in the Benedict option, he thinks, for, again, legal protection as distinct from trying to enact policies that promote a Christian view of life. And it's interesting that he capitalized Orthodox there, which suggests and means Eastern Orthodox. I think he's still Eastern Orthodox. He was Protestant and then Catholic, and then now he's Eastern Orthodox. But he means very clearly Eastern Orthodox, Catholic, and I suppose you'd say kind of mere Christianity Protestants like C.S. Lewis, like, you know, the journal Mere Christianity, all those together can share in this Benedict option vision. And as well, that there's quite a variety within it, so that on the one hand, it could mean literally becoming a Benedictine monk or nun or living around one, going, establishing farming communities, small towns. He mentioned St. Mary's, Pennsylvania is a place where he thinks you can move to get a solid blue-collar job where there's a strong Catholic classical school network, or places like Hagerstown, Maryland, which is outside of D.C. that he points to, St. Jerome's Academy providing a focal point for suburbanites and people who are working in D.C. So there's quite a variety within the Benedict option, but I'm still going to say that I think there's not enough variety there. And I also don't think there's enough cautions against the very real dangers of people who try to take this up without proper formation. And that's the final section, a Thomistic response to the Benedict option, the complementary of the Dominic, Benedict, and McGivney options. Okay, so the first thing we want to think about is the virtue of prudence and then the gift of the Holy Spirit of counsel. Then when we're talking about options, first and foremost, we need to develop our natural capacity to reason well about practical matters. We need to form that in grace so that when we undergo any action, especially such a large question of the kind of jobs you should get after college, whether or not you are called to priestly or religious life or to lay life, that this requires the virtue of prudence and the gift of counsel, and especially if someone's going to make the claim that we are at the end of an era. I don't think that's the sort of thing that prudence can tell us. I would say that we do need an insight provided by God to see providentially that we are at the end of an era. So I'd be very cautious about the claim that we could know that we are in a post-Christian world definitively, as distinct from a low coin that will lead to a restoration. So here's how Aquinas puts the relationship between these in quote 4a. Prudence directs man in the research of counsel according to principles that the reason can grasp. Hence, prudence makes man take good counsel either for himself or for another. Since, however, human reason is unable to grasp the singular and contingent things which may occur, the result is that the thoughts of mortal men are fearful and our counsels uncertain. Hence, in the research of counsel, man requires to be directed by God who comprehends all things, and this is done through the gift of counsel, whereby man is directed as though counseled by God, just as in human affairs, those who are unable to take counsel for themselves seek counsel from those who are wiser. So if you think that the Benedict option is, this is the time, you know, this is while we still can get out, we can imagine something like living in East Germany after World War II and waking up and realizing I missed the chance to leave. You can't get out now. Okay, you think those things are true. Coming to know them requires, I'm going to talk about three different things here. First, prayer and fasting. This comes on your knees before the Eucharist in discernment. This can't be a political agenda. And I think part of the concern, and I don't know Rod Dreher's very well, but when I look at what Dreher says on X and what he's doing, that the concern is that Christianity is, being a good Christian is becomes a means toward Christian civilization or a means toward a Christian politics. Christian living is the end. That is the goal of life, to live out our union with God and to seek our salvation. If civilization comes for that, that's wonderful. That is an added good to it. And in general, a healthy civilization flows from that leaven of the faith. But it can't. We can't instrumentalize that. I think that there are quite a few people in the political sphere who really are doing that, a kind of Christianity that is a prop for a political end. There's a very good talk that First Things, Paul Kingsnorth is his name, gave a talk this year called Against Christian Civilization. It's on YouTube. I'd recommend watching that. I don't agree with quite a few of the things he says, actually, but I think he's really good on at least this point that that the problem, Christians need to look at themselves and say, to what extent are we to blame? And that's the second point, that we want to avoid the us versus them thinking, which is, I think, what happened during COVID, that it was really a tool of a kind of secular person in America to really divide Americans into privileged and underprivileged and so forth, and that politics is a zero-sum game where we are against them. There's a kind of Marxism inherent in that approach, and we need to be aware of that. Sin isn't out there. Sin is in my heart. It's in your heart. If you go to the monastery, if you go to that Benedict Option community, you're bringing sin with you. If you're without sin, if you are already a saint and not a saint in the making, that is wonderful, but I would not claim that of myself. And I think we need to be very cautious about the ways in which we can let our guard down when we think that we are among friends, right? That we are all Christians here and we're all the good ones and we're all the saved. That is a very dangerous way of thinking. And that leads to my third point of being aware of wolves in sheep's clothing. You know, that I think the dangers of charismatic leadership, of people who are really unstable themselves and who may have great ideas and be very good at speaking and persuading people, but who are either themselves marred by disorder, unintentionally, addictions, or who are actually exploiting people and using this as a means to use others. And there are countless examples of this, of people in recent years forming communities only to find out that the leader was a charlatan. So we'd have to be very cautious about that. And instead, I would say, to point back to the literal Benedict option, is to say, if you really feel called to something like this, go to a Benedict monastery. Like St. Leo's. I don't know much about St. Leo's, actually. It's a daughter abbey of ours, but here in Florida. St. Vincent Arch Abbey, where I am, is the largest Benedictine monastery in the world. There's over 150 monks there, and they also run a priory in Savannah, Georgia. So if you're interested, I didn't need this to get pitched. I don't have any real estate to sell, so don't worry about that. But if you want to talk to her, I don't have any real estate. So, but I would really encourage that seriously to say, as you're in your college journey and moving forward, to say, take some time for discernment. Go to a Benedictine monastery or a Dominican priory for prayer and discernment, and ask, what is my calling? And is my calling, when I make a career choice, and this is where I agree with Dreher, to recognize that I have to recognize my career choice has to be put in the context of a vocation. And it's very easy for Christians to fall into a secularized way of thinking about life, that later on I'll do the vocation thing. Right now I got to establish practical living, enough money to support myself, and then later on I will settle my state of life, which I think is a big mistake. And Dreher is very helpful in calling attention to that. Okay, so if you were to pursue a Benedict option community, either by becoming a monk or nun, by living in communion or next to a Benedictine monastery, or forming a community of lay people in a rural or urban, suburban area, does Aquinas provide resources for thinking about that? And I think yes, in at least two ways. The first one is the relationship between custom and law, that Aquinas would not take a top-down law approach. That's a very modern understanding of law, that the sovereign establishes the law and just brings it down to the people and uses the intermediary agencies to direct it to individuals. That is not Aquinas' thinking. And so what Aquinas can provide for us is seeing how the customs of a community like this can become normative and establish law over time, probably over a generation or more. And in two different ways, let's look at Aquinas on this. By actions also, especially if they repeated so as to make a custom, law can be changed and expounded, and also something can be established which obtains force of law. Accordingly, custom has the force of a law, abolishes law, and is the interpreter of law. The people among whom a custom is introduced may be of two conditions. So think of ourselves. Which condition do you think you would say you're in? If they are free and able to make their own laws, the consent of the whole people expressed by a custom counts far more in favor of a particular observance than does the authority of the sovereign, who has not the power to frame laws except as representing the people. Wherefore, although each individual cannot make laws, yet the whole people can. If, however, the people have not the free power to make their own laws or to abolish a law made by a higher authority, nevertheless, with such a people, a prevailing custom obtains force of law, insofar as it is tolerated by those to whom it belongs to make laws for that people, because by the very fact that they tolerate it, they seem to approve of that which is introduced by custom. Okay, if we imagine a Benedict option community in that first instance, probably we're talking a small town or a farming community, where there are enough people, perhaps a majority of that small community, that some of the members are going to get on town council, are going to become mayor, are going to be in the police department, fire department, and so forth. And that over time, the customs of that church community, that the local customs there, are going to be connected to in healthy ways. For example, things like, we're going to have a Corpus Christi procession. And every year, the authorities recognize that this is a holiday, that we're going to close down the streets, and that there will be an observance here. The state is not, the city is not worshiping. It's that the city is cooperating with and helping to support the customs of a people. This could be enshrined in city codes, in things like, we can imagine, in Latrobe, we have a public nuisance law that's pretty broad, you know. So if you're down at the park and there's a bunch of, this happened, you know, not too long ago, a bunch of teenagers, you know, swearing like sailors, and moms are there with their kids, you know, we can call the police. Our policy is broad enough that that's not tolerated in our community. We could imagine ways of doing that that would, while not at the state or the national level, be supported necessarily, that there would be a buffer zone, as it were, for local school districts, local churches, local celebrations and feasts and so forth. But we may be in the second situation, particularly in an urban area, particularly in a suburb or a big city, where the chances that this Benedict community will be able to guide even that local politics are very slim. D.C. is a great example of that. I mean, it's without hope in the D.C. government that you're going to be able to do that. What you instead do is you keep your head down, you try to behave yourself in public, and, you know, pursue peace with your neighbors, be supportive of neighbors and works of corporal works of mercy and the like, and seek to establish a solid enough custom among people who are stable there, so that when pardon the image, the Eye of Sauron shines itself on that community, it can't last for very long. You know, you realize they're going to look at you, they're going to sense what's going on for a brief period of time, and then they move on somewhere else, and then there's a new pharaoh. And maybe the new pharaoh is going to be somebody who's actually friendly to this and who's going to create laws that will protect the religious liberty. And you'll say, we already have everything in place. We just need someone to press the button, and we've got it here. So Aquinas does provide that resource of a kind of quiet custom that, while not protected necessarily by law, is tolerated by the legal authorities. A second resource, and again, I'm sure there are more, but I'm going to wrap up with this in Aquinas, is at the end of the Secunda Secundae, he's trying to think through what is the best way of Christian living. He's gone through all the virtues, the gifts, and the fruits of the Holy Spirit, the way of the Beatitudes, and now he wants to be more concrete with what today people use the term vocation or state of life, to say his focus, though, is on priestly and religious life, not on lay, so we would need to expand upon that. But in general, what does he want to say? That the best way of life is one that is active, as rooted in contemplation. The next best is a contemplative life. And the third in order is an active life of, you know, what we today call things like acts of charity and corporal works of mercy. So let's read how he talks about that, and then we'll try to unpack it in responding to the Benedict option. 4c. For even as it is better to enlighten than merely to shine, so is it better to give to others the fruit of one's contemplation than merely to contemplate. The other work of the active life consists entirely in outward occupation, for instance, almsgiving, receiving guests, and the like, which are less excellent than the works of contemplation, except in cases of necessity. Accordingly, the highest place in religious orders is held by those which are directed to teaching and preaching, which moreover are nearest to the episcopal perfection, that of the bishop. Even as in other things, the end of that which is first is in conjunction with the beginning of that which is second, as Dionysius says. The second place belongs to those which are directed to contemplation, and the third to those which are occupied with external actions. Okay, so how would I cash this out here? The Benedict option, again, I already think we should be cautious about a new and different Benedict option. I would say, let's look at the one that's actually existing that has a 1,500-year tradition behind it. The second thing is that I think that the Benedict option approach of Dreyer narrows too much the Christian understanding of vocation and closes off important parts of tradition, of scripture, of Christian living that are a calling for people, whether as priestly and religious or as lay. And so I'm putting this in terms of, and we should have seen this coming. Aquinas was not a Benedicta. Okay, so are we aware of this, right? So he lived in a Benedictine monastery. He dies at a Cistercian monastery. The last thing he ever wrote was written as a deferential son to the abbot of Monte Cassino as a Benedictine. So Aquinas isn't rejecting the Benedictines, right? He is discerning a call for himself to the Dominic option, to a life of preaching and teaching, to getting the best education available at the universities of his time, and of our times we would pursue this as well, so as to evangelize the culture using those intellectual resources. And so Christians today, if we are in a post-Christian America, need to take seriously that option as well. The third then would be what I'm going to call the McGivney option, after Blessed Michael McGivney, the founder of the Knights of Columbus, that either a religious or a lay order that commits itself to fraternal works of mercy and serves kind of as an alternative to the social services provided by the state. And so I think, especially given that, you know, most of you are in college, as you discern, you know, going forward, to recognize that there are these three ways of Christian living that respond to different charisms and talents that we may have, and that if we feel a call to more like a farming or manual labor, lay a way of life, a hidden life for a quiet life, that's a good reason to discern going to a Benedictine monastery and either, again, becoming a monk or nun or becoming an oblate, which is a third order, a lay person that's attached to it. If we feel a calling more to the intellectual life and to intellectual engagement like we're doing here, we could say, this is what the Thomistic Institute option is, right? Is that while it's run by Dominicans, most of the chapters are run by lay people who are trying to get the best philosophical and theological formation available to them to not only form themselves, but also to teach, if not to preach. And then finally, if you feel called to helping the poor and the needy among us in these very concrete and bodily ways, then to either, again, form a religious community or to do so as a lay person who I think would still want to try to be bound to an order like the Knights of Columbus to help encourage and build one another up as bands of brothers and sisters who can live more fully this Christian life. And so I think in the short, then, I'm not necessarily critical of the idea of the Benedict Doctrine. I guess in some way I'm living it. I teach at the Benedictine Monastery. I go to the monastery for Mass and for spiritual direction and live in a small town that is obviously benefited by the stable presence of the monastic community. But I'd be very cautious, again, about an undue closing off and a precipitous claim that all is over and all is doomed and we need to head to the hills.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.